I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Here's a common sight for most of America's TV news viewers, a 60-something gray-haired man sitting at the anchor's desk delivering headlines. What's not so common? An older woman doing the same thing. While newsrooms are generally thought of as progressive places to work, it seems like TV news might have a weak spot. Today I'll ask the media critics about that double standard, and we'll explore how the internet age is affecting job satisfaction among journalists. Later, KCUR's Jim McLean explains why Kevin Yoder might be worried about his future in Kansas's 3rd Congressional District. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Earlier this year, Karen Fuller, a former news anchor at KCTV 5 in Kansas City, filed an age and gender discrimination suit against the Meredith Corporation, which owns the station. Fuller alleged that the company had created an age ceiling for female anchors, but not for the men. Women age out in their mid to late 40s, the lawsuit alleges. And that got us to thinking, when's the last time you saw a 65-year-old anchor woman, or even a 60-year-old female reporter? They're out there, but pretty rare. What's with that, and why do we allow such a double standard to exist? We'll get the lowdown this morning from our media critics, and they are Peggy Lowe is Harvest Public Media's investigations editor here at KCUR. Peggy, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Pam Fine is the Knight Chair in News Leadership and Community at the University of Kansas School of Journalism. Pam, welcome back.
Thank you, Steve.
And Dana Wright is also back. She spent almost 12 years as a news anchor and reporter at KCTV 5 News in Kansas City. In 2012, she became half of Dana and Parks, heard from 2 to 4, 2 to 6, weekday afternoons on 98.1 FM KMBZ. And Dana, good to have you.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
You know, Dana, given all your TV experience, may I ask, did you age out of the TV business, or asking it bluntly, did you become too old for the tube?
I burned out of the TV business.
You burned out.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's different. It is different. I think, you know, I had 4 children. I was in 17 years. I started in Topeka and then moved to Kansas City. 17 years with 4 children is a long time to be in that grind.
Yeah.
I will start off by saying Karen Fuller's a friend of mine. I worked with her. I had dinner with her 2 weeks ago at the Clinton Library in Little Rock. I personally did not see age discrimination at my time at Channel 5. I just didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I will remind everyone that Karen replaced a younger news anchor when she came in by the name of Dee Griffin. They brought her in from out of state. Dee Griffin replaced Ann Peterson, mm-hmm. who was on the air, as you know, for decades. Also, full disclosure, dear friend of mine. And so, you know, there was somewhat of a revolving door at Channel 5 when I was there. I did not personally see age as one of the reasons for that revolving door.
How about, though, the industry writ large? Step back a few feet,
yep,
from Channel 5. What do you see out there when it comes to older women and their role in the pantheon of TV news?
You know, absolutely, it's a problem. It is a problem. And we can look at some of the reasons behind that, societal reasons, societal expectations. My husband has been at Channel 9 for 35 years.
Chris Katz, I should say.
Yes. Yeah. They do a very good job of keeping the women who are local to this community on the air there. If you look at Peggy Bright and Kelly Eckerman and Karen Kornacki, they have decades and decades of experience,
right,
in this city on the air. But if you look at the other stations, they are the exception to that rule. I do believe that.
You know, Pam Fine, one aspect of all this, this issue of older women on TV that absolutely befuddles me, is this lack of outrage you hear from society at large directed at this phenomenon that we often, most of the time, don't see older women on local TV news stations here in Kansas City or anywhere for that matter. Why is that?
Yeah, I think because we accept it as a matter of fact that we like culturally to see attractive people on our shows, and we've been trained to expect that. I would say, you know, nationally, there was backlash to what happened at Fox News with Roger Ailes and Megyn Kelly and others, and this whole issue of ageism, not only in journalism, but across corporate America, is really coming to the fore right now. It's it's amazing how many companies are experiencing backlash. We saw that this week with the Google memo.
Yes.
So you're familiar with that, of course.
Yeah.
This engineer wrote a 10-page memo saying that women biologically were different from men and therefore couldn't be successful engineers in the tech industry. So you know, I think it's you know, been a paternalistic society and a long time practice for TV news. And, you know, I hate to say this, but I think women are part of the problem, too, that we want to see people we want to be like on the air. And we all want to be attractive and, you know, talented.
Yeah.
But attractive is important.
Let's get our listeners involved here. What do you make of this seeming double standard that seems to stop women from continuing their television news careers past the age of 50, or maybe it's 45? Does it bother you or not? 816-235-2888 is our number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Peggy Lowe, you know, even the most ardent feminists oftentimes don't talk about this issue. And again, I'm a little befuddled by it.
It's a very uncomfortable issue, you know. And quite frankly, when your producer, Danny, sent us an email saying, let's come on your show today and talk about it, I thought, oh, God, do I have to talk about this again? I think, you know, part of it for me is just the exhaustion around the issue. I'm tired of it. I've been in the media for 30 years, and I've heard it for a long time. And
but,
of course,
but it's not argued about that much publicly. You don't hear it debated in journalism circles, or even much less on talk shows like this very often.
It's old news, you know.
Okay.
I mean, the big case was from the 80s, Christine Kraft,
yes,
who was fired from a Kansas City station. That made national news. I didn't live here back then.
She wasn't differential enough to men.
Right. Here's here is the title of her book, and I absolutely love it. Too Old, Too Ugly, Not Differential to Men. That's a hell of a title.
Yeah.
And that kind of sums it up for a lot of women, not just in TV, I would add, but also in other parts of the media.
Okay. Do you expect this to change? Are you seeing society starting to rear up against all of this, Pam?
Well, I hope so. You know, one of the trends is more women news directors in television, and we hope that the people who are in a position to hire and cultivate talent respect people of all ages and recognize the value of maturity and seasoning, because it does make a difference in the quality of the journalism presented.
Dana?
I've always made the comment, would you rather watch someone who can find City Hall, like a Mike Mahoney, or someone who has no idea where they're going or what they're doing, but look, they look really, really pretty? That's always bothered me. The other leg of this conversation that we need to have is that the salaries for entry reporters have come crashing down to the ground by tens of thousands of dollars, even from when I started back in 1992, I believe it was. And so the pool of talent from which they have to draw with a limited and shrinking budget in a newsroom is going to get you someone now probably straight out of a better college like the University of Kansas or maybe Mizzou. Whereas I think before you had to go make your mistakes in a smaller market like a Topeka or a Joplin or a Wichita and then make your way to Kansas City when you had some experience. That is not true today. We are seeing very, very young people, kids. I look up and I say, who are these people? Because they're cheap. They are cheap to hire.
Yeah.
You can hire three or four of them for every seasoned veteran reporter.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Let's go to some calls. And Tom from Mission Hills. Tom, good morning.
Steve, this is and Dana, this is Tom Lawrence. I anchored at Fox 4 for years.
You bet, Tom.
NBC 41 before that. It's I think there's no question that there's age discrimination against women and men. I think the Karen Fuller case is age and possibly money. As Dana was saying, the people are bringing in now are much cheaper than the kind of money that we used to make. And it's easy to knock off a high salary and bring in a lower salary it makes the bottom line look better and doesn't affect the ratings all that much.
Tom, how surprised are you that listeners don't object to this kind of thing more often?
You know, I think they do. The people that I talk to, first of all, they miss Karen Fuller. And Dana and I, or I used to tell Dana that she and I would be a great team together. They miss Karen Fuller, and they say, you know, I don't want to cast negative comments about people on the air now, but they say, who are these kids?
Mm-hmm.
You know, as Dana was saying, the reporters are barely out of college. In many cases, the anchors have had a couple of years of experience, which just isn't quite enough for a market of this size. But then conversely, as she said, the money they're paying, they can't get the really fine talent, as we call it, that the bigger markets can afford.
Tom, you began your comments by saying that all of this affects women and men when it comes to the aging factor here. Tell me about the male end of this, because we really haven't touched on that yet.
Well, this is, you know, this is an interesting market because Larry Moore sort of owned Kansas City TV News for years, for decades, and Phil Witt was right behind him. So Larry is retired. I think Larry is in his late 60s, maybe early 70s. Phil is somewhere in his 60s. And you look around now, John Holt may be the oldest. Maybe Chris Ketz is the oldest. I don't even know. I don't know how old they are. So it's not the situation. When I was anchoring in my mid-career, it was the middle-aged anchor and his younger trophy wife, co-anchor. That was the image they were looking for. So the guy with some maturity and polish and the younger woman who was hopefully attractive, I hate to say that, experienced and accomplished as well. But they thought that was a good balance.
Hmm.
That's what they said. I don't defend that
right
by any stretch.
Well, Tom, I'm glad you called.
For men.
Yeah, I appreciate it very much. Let's go to Joan from Kansas City, Missouri. Joan, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about why we don't see older women on TV news very often. Joan, good morning.
Good morning. I graduated college in 1980, and I was older than most of the other graduates, and I got an internship at KMBC Television, and I was thrilled. And then I started seeing things happening, and I was there with Christine Kraft and Pam Whiting. And it got ugly real quick, and myself and some other interns left because we knew what was coming down the pike for Christine, because it was made very clear to us that she was a dog, blah, blah, blah. And I got out of television altogether because being a woman that was 30 years old, I didn't see anything good happening. And the other gal stayed in TV. She went with public television where they don't care what you look like as long as you're good. And I don't know. It just set the tone for me. And, of course, I also found this in corporate, but not near the extent of what I saw. And I was just so disappointed because I got an internship at KMBC. I was thrilled. But it got ugly really quick, and it's very disheartening because Christine was a brilliant reporter, so was Pam Whiting, but they didn't like the way she looked. So I'm just saying, and I know this goes back even farther, but I was there for that mess. I saw it up front. I couldn't believe the comments that men were making out loud in front of all of us. Mm-hmm. So that's all I got to say. It's ugly, and it hasn't gotten any better, and I'm really really disappointed that it hasn't gotten better.
Let's hop on Joan's last point there. Yeah. It's such a good one. This Christine Kraft case was in the mid-1980s. She was demoted at age 37. 37, folks, after being told she was too old, too unattractive, and wouldn't defer to men. Did that case change anything, Peggy?
Well, she won the battle and lost the war, as you recall.
Yeah.
So she won the case and was awarded no money.
No money.
Nothing.
She won a $500,000 award and a $350,000 award, and both were later tossed out.
Correct. And so here's what I will say. I think it hasn't changed on its face if you really look at the makeup of most newsrooms, but it's not as overt as you are too ugly and not deferential enough to men.
It's more hidden today.
It's more hidden today. No one is going to say to a woman, you're too old and too ugly. What they will say is, we are looking for a female to complement our seasoned male news anchor when they
There's
are looking.
There's new code words, basically.
There's new code words. it's certainly not as overt as it was. No one's going to be that stupid today because of the lawsuits. I mean, right. She really laid the ground for that.
Is this an issue among your students at KU, those who might be looking at a career in TV news? Do they recognize that the ceiling is pretty darn low?
I'm not sure they do. And obviously,
well, they're young.
Yeah. And we don't focus on it. And like our colleagues on this show said, they're getting jobs because they are young and they're willing to go to markets that may be very small and take jobs for little pay. But, you know, we do counsel them to be aware that these issues are out there and to try to be resilient and able to weather all kinds of interactions in the workplace that might be discriminatory or otherwise unpleasant.
But they're young. Who cares? We got great futures ahead. Let's go to Loy from Independence. Loy, you're on Up to Date.
It's interesting to me that voice quality is so important. You know, on radio and on NPR, you have these wonderful voices like Ann Taylor and Lakshmi Singh. On television, sometimes the voice quality of some of the particularly younger women grates on my nerves.
Okay. Just because they're young and seemingly inexperienced, Loy?
It seems to me it's the younger ones that have this nasal quality.
Yeah.
And what does that have to do with good reporting? Your guest today has a very nice radio voice. I enjoy listening to her. And some of the women on NPR, national radio.
Right.
These beautiful, well-modulated voices.
Peggy, I'm sorry, Loy, I had to move on here. Peggy, what were you going to say there?
I just wondered if Loy felt the same way about young men.
Loy?
This is true, yes.
Okay.
You know, one of the things that I will say that I noticed coming up as a young reporter was, number one, I benefited from being young and out of school when I first started. So looking back now, it's easy to say it bothers me that things are this way or that way. They hired me at WIBW when I had no business being on the air.
Mm-hmm.
I was maybe 20, just didn't have a home or a family or
you were lost in the world.
I was living in my parents' basement. I, you know, and so I look back and I think, my gosh, someone did take that chance on me, and I turned that into a 25-year career. I do wish I had had the skills, and maybe this goes back to our collegiate teaching, to speak up when you do see things that are inappropriate. And I was so young and so afraid to lose my job. I didn't have the confidence to know that I am good at what I do, to speak up when you do see things that are wrong. And I'll give you a quick example. I was 10 months pregnant, not 9, 10. They lie to you when they say it's 9. And I was sitting at my desk one day logging tape, and I was wearing tennis shoes. I was swollen as a grape. And my then boss came over and said, "You need to come into my office. We're going to have a discussion about your footwear." And I remember being so upset and so afraid that I was going to be fired or that I was very young at the time at Channel 5. Looking back now, knowing everything I know now, as a now 43-year-old with some life experience, I would have handled that so differently. And I remember just being afraid and thinking, I'll go put on high heels. Of course, I'm so sorry that I'm sitting at my desk wearing tennis shoes, 10 months pregnant. I think I gave birth 3 days later. And so part of what I would love to teach young women coming through the ranks is you can speak up. I would have found another job. I should have told him to stick it. And I didn't because I was afraid. And I don't know that a man in that same position at that age would have done the same thing.
Let's go to Carl from Leawood. Carl, you're on Up to Date. Our topic, why more older women aren't on local TV news. Carl, good morning.
Good morning. And, you know, I guess I would summarize that by saying the old advertising agency expression, sex sells. You know, a lot of these young things that are out there doing their thing on the news broadcasts are basically eye candy. I mean, that's the way they seem to be cast, because they certainly don't have a broad background in journalism, and they certainly don't have, as the other caller pointed out, the voice that's necessary for it. So I think a lot of times this is the fault of the producers of the program that are trying to raise their ratings. They're trying to get more advertisers, and that's what they end up doing. You know, you look at older women in the news, and I would certainly point to Judy Woodruff, and the now departed but wonderful cohort that was with her, Glenn Ifill, as two women who were not senior but certainly close to it, and did an awesome job. They do an awesome job on the news. So it's really a matter, I think, of we've lost, you know, news is becoming infotainment.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to get those ratings. And, gee, you know, a cute young thing on the air certainly tends to be eye candy.
Carl, thank you. Anyone want to disagree with the notion that sex sells and that's what this is all about?
No.
Heck no.
We've created that environment. And that's not a media problem.
That's societal.
That's a societal problem.
Yeah. Let's go to Bill from Overland Park. Bill, you're on the program. Good morning.
Good morning. I called in to Channel 5 when, first I missed Dana Wright, and then I called in when they got rid of Katie Horner. And I actually spoke to the general manager, and he promised me that the people to replace them were there to last 20 years. And frankly, I don't think they understand that with age comes intellect, and that the news stories are better covered. I think that the rapid fire, never ending talk of MSNBC and the other one, CNN, is so fast that you can't understand it. There's no meaning to it. There's no nothing. I prefer older people, and I was even sorry to see Matt Stewart
yeah.
go
right.
five.
Right.
That's all I have to say. Thank
yeah,
you.
Bill. Thank you for the call. Rick from Kansas City, Kansas. You're on the air, Rick.
Hey, you know, notwithstanding the convention that she went to in a fetching dress 30 years ago to get an undercover story, Amy Goodman is one of the most fabulous journalists of our time. I think the reason she's still on the air is because I'm pretty sure she's pretty high up in the hierarchy of running Democracy Now. So that's why she's still there, you know. And so then you got to look at who are the hierarchy, who are the people that are running the operation that are making these decisions to get women out when they're, you know, highly intelligent and
capable,
not just fetching in a pretty
dress. Thank you, Rick. Pam Fine from KU.
Well, picking up on Rick, you know, one of the questions I have is, especially in our time when the news media is under considerable fire from public officials and others, whether there's a correlation between maturity and seasoning and good journalism and credibility and trust, which the news industry so needs. Mm-hmm. So maybe this is a moment, excuse me, where, you know, the industry itself will look inward and say, gee, do we need to put or respect
yes.
people who have more experience because that will help engender trust and credibility?
Let's do this. Let's take a break, and we'll move on to some other topics with our good media critics here. We're going to talk about digital disruption and what journalism students should be taught these days. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, we learned how opioid abuse is affecting Johnson County, and we asked why sports matter so much to Kansas City. Find those conversations at kcur.org or on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, we explore the complex social, cultural, and economic factors of health problems in the Black community. Also, we get a rundown on the results of tonight's election in Kansas City. Well, this hour, we're visiting with our media critics, KCUR's Peggy Lowe, KU's Pam Fine, and Dana Wright from 98.1 FM KMBZ. She's half of Dana and Parks. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. This is going to be in Artful and the Extreme. But just to wrap up our first half segment on older women and the lack of them in local TV news, I wanted to give Christina Kraft the last say here. A few years ago, she acknowledged that things had gotten a little better for women on TV. The main difference, she said, is that the women have to have two facelifts for every one facelift for the males. So there you go. We'll leave that with Christina Kraft. Let's move on to a new University of Kansas study that shows that digital disruption, or how journalism has evolved in the internet era, is altering American newsrooms. The internet, the study found, has changed how newspapers deliver content and how journalists practice their profession. The study found that different positions in the newsroom have been affected differently. Sports writers seem to be happy. Copy editors, not so much. Pam Fine from KU, I'm wondering, there's no question, is there, that the internet has revolutionized the news business in ways we're still learning about, I think.
Right. Excuse me. Absolutely. Every job within certainly newspaper newsrooms has changed in the last decade. You're expected to be able to do multiple things now, where once, you know, a reporter reported and wrote and story was published, today that a reporter is a one-man band who can take videos, shoot pictures, secure audio. So the days of just doing one thing in a newsroom have changed. And of course, that linear production process that newspapers relied on is now a circular process, because you're publishing all the time, not just, you know, in the wee hours of the morning, the newspaper going to press and delivered a few hours later.
Now, here's how old I am. When I first began my career in Freeport, Illinois, at the daily newspaper there, I can remember on a Monday hearing from my boss about some great story that ran the Chicago Tribune that he wanted me to duplicate that week for our paper. I remember sitting down at a typewriter and typing out, "Dear Chicago Tribune, would you please mail me the story that ran in your paper? You know, I could really use it for a story I'm going to work on here," and praying the dang thing arrived by Thursday so I could, you know, turn around and write my story. That's how old I am.
That's
Peggy.
Very funny.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, why are you pointing at me? I'm not that old.
Because you're right here. Yeah. Hey, how have things changed from your vantage point, Peggy? Because one thing I hear a lot is that journalists don't go out and cover a story anymore. They go out and report, then they shoot a video, then they write the story, they post it on Facebook, they post it on Twitter, and then they go talk about it on a podcast, and the whole process sometimes can be absolutely overwhelming.
I absolutely love that we have this immediacy in journalism. I'm an old wire service reporter, and so I dig that I can get on Twitter and start breaking news. I love that. I was at a newspaper in Southern California, and we went web first in 2006. I love multimedia. I love what it can produce, images coupled with sound. I love all of it. But I will say this, and I always say this to classes. I often talk to Professor Fine's class at KU. The dirty little secret of multimedia and the internet is it's a hell of a lot of work.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Just to do a spot, which is just like a little piece of news that we might do in a newscast here at KCUR, for instance. You know, we'll do a couple different versions. We'll get the audio, you turn it into a web post, you tweet it, you Facebook it. It's a lot of work. So we are grinding a lot more all day, every day than we ever did before.
In television news, unfortunately, it has, I believe, watered down the product, because even as I was leaving 6-7 years ago,
right,
the television world, they would say you need 2 stories per day. So you're going to cover a fire at 5 and 6, and then at 9 you need to go run and cover this meeting, and at 10 we're going to put you on something else because there's been a shooting. And so it doesn't take many skills, quite frankly, to cover a shooting or a fire.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't. My last several years at Channel 5, I was the chief investigative reporter, and we were given time. Just the beauty of time.
I remember that.
And we did some wonderful things with that time. Unfortunately, very, very few newsrooms are willing to pay for the resources it takes, and I know that this is the same in the newspaper industry, to give you time to really do great journalism. Covering fires and shootings is not great journalism. That's the daily news grind of the day. I think as a country, we need to be worried that there is not more watchdog journalism keeping track of what's going on in our local communities. Forget national stuff. What is affecting you locally right now? And who's keeping an eye on city government, on school boards? We do not have the resources in these newsrooms anymore to send reporters to cover local government. We don't.
That's right.
They're too busy tweeting and Facebooking and podcasting and just trying to crank out the news of the day. And that's sad.
We're seeing that particularly there's this annual survey that at least it was done for a bunch of years. The American Journalism Review did of State House reporters. I'm an old State House reporter, so I used to look at this stuff. The number of State House reporters around the country just dropping like the stock market during the Great Depression. I mean, it's just unbelievable how few reporters watch these massive multi-billion dollar operations that traffic in taxpayer dollars, Pam.
Yeah, that's a huge issue and being discussed widely right now. A lot of foundations are looking at that, trying to figure out how they can supplement coverage at the state and regional level, and confederations of groups like even Harvest Public Radio. You have organizations who are figuring out how to work together so that they can provide more coverage of state and regional operations.
So what is all this stuff, all this massive workload on journalists, what's it doing to journalistic satisfaction? How much reporters and editors and copy editors and producers enjoy the work they do? What's your sense, Peggy?
Well, I think a lot of journalists are just quite frankly stressed out. You know, when I was in Southern California, I survived 10 rounds of layoffs and buyouts. And so there was always this white noise of all of us worried that today was the day we were going to get laid off. So that's very stressful. And certainly people who made it their niche and their actual just the beauty of what they did for a living. I'm thinking of the New York Times, and recently there's been this big layoff of copy editors. And there's just been kind of a revolt at the Times about it because copy editors saved everybody. They were good at catching the errors, at the writing. And those jobs are becoming sort of ancient and you know, they're about ready to go away.
You can't afford them anymore.
That's pretty sad. Yeah. There's a lot of people who get out of the business, quite frankly.
I can't tell you how many times those folks saved my paycheck.
Steve,
you got a thing here. Oh, really? Thank you very much.
The problem is, and I know I would love for you guys to weigh in on this, how do you monetize the digital arm of what has become so important with what we do? You can tell people, go to our Facebook page, go to our website, go to our Twitter feed and look at the product that we are providing the community. It's really hard to turn that into money. And journalism, at the end of the day, it's a calling, but it's a business. And I think newspapers are the first front of this problem where we're seeing the really big newspapers struggling. The Kansas City Star struggling because people are going to their phones and they're not buying the hard copy newspaper that comes to the door.
Yeah.
But I think that to the expectations of the large newspaper chains for double-digit profits has really been a factor. And I was with a couple of newspaper analysts this week who talked about the profits at newspapers still being very good relative to other businesses. So I think it's a matter of expectation about what those digital revenues should be. And we're seeing more and more growth in digital revenues. The other thing that's happening is that subscribers are finally paying full freight for newspapers, where for many years the numbers in newspaper circulation were high because the advertising was supplementing delivery.
Pam, so, I can't tell you how happy I am to hear what you just said as a guy who still makes a living in part at the Kansas City Star. That surprises me a little bit that analysts are as bullish on newspapers as you just described, because my sense is things ain't that good.
Yeah, no, don't get me wrong. I would say they're not necessarily bullish, but the reality is that there's still money to be made. And you have companies that are buying newspapers. There have been many recent sales lately because the money is still pretty good. It's just that it isn't as good as it once was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the days of 30 to 40% margins are gone.
Yeah.
I think there, too, that there's a really interesting new model coming about, and Pam just said something about Harvest Public Media, and I've been in, you know, since the beginning on that, as well as, to your point about state houses, we have the Kansas News Service here now at KCUR, which is a major commitment by this tiny little radio station to cover Kansas. We have probably more reporters across Kansas than anybody else. Now,
it's
Kansas
amazing.
Is small, of course, but we are covering that state house up one side and down the other. And it's really wonderful. And that is funded, at least right now, by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So, as you said, some foundations are stepping up to kind of step into the void here. But so I think we're seeing that rise as a nonprofit, and that's good news.
I would even challenge the television stations, and I know that this is blasphemy. You know, there are stations that have decided to share a helicopter. That's a very big expense. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, you're looking down at the same car wreck. So we're starting to see some partnerships in that regard. And you brought up earlier, why are we not pooling resources when it comes to the most important news to the day? Four stations cannot send four reporters to Topeka to cover the state house, mm-hmm. but they could all send one. They could send one.
But wait a minute, though. I mean,
it's never going to happen.
Don't TV stations have a greater obligation than what we see? I'm going to get on my horse here for a moment, because you watch the ad revenue that flows into those stations every 2 years from politicians and their campaigns that total not tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands.
Millions.
We're talking millions and millions. And yet the TV station's commitment, the broad commitment to covering City Hall, to covering state houses, to covering, you know, things other than crime and grime, you got to be kidding me.
It has become reactive. What it has become is reactive, so that if something happens, you react and you send a reporter. It is not preemptive anymore, where you just send a reporter to dig around and see what's happening. Mm-hmm. Those days are just gone. Ask any news director the last time they sent someone to Topeka just to spend a day and dig around. They'll look at you like you're crazy.
But my question is, should that be the case? Don't
Absolutely,
those stations have enough money to finance the kind of reporting you're talking about? My sense is the answer is you bet it they do have enough money, but yet they won't make that kind of commitment.
Right.
Because and it just makes me crazy.
Because there's a fire or a car wreck here,
yes.
and that's easier, it's closer.
And it's cheaper.
And it's cheaper.
To cover with a younger reporter, yeah. Pam, anything about this you want to throw in?
Well, I do want to say that, you know, we're talking with a lot of doom and gloom, but I do think journalism is an important and interesting field, and I would hope that any young people listening to this program still consider it a vital and valuable occupation. There's been a tremendous proliferation of investigative sites and other local and national news sites in this digital age, and I think that there are a lot of opportunities to report on stories that are interesting to people and fill gaps in some of the coverage areas. So I do want to say that all of your listeners ought to take advantage of the options for multiple news sources that exist here and around the country.
Okay. I want to thank our very good guests here for coming into our conversation here today, our media critics. Dana Wright, again, half of Dana and Parks, heard it every day from 2 to 6, 98.1 FM KMBZ. Pam Fine, the Knight Chair in News Leadership and Community over at KU, and Peggy Lowe here from Harvest Public Media at KCUR. Thanks for a great conversation, guys. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
The congressman from Kansas's 3rd Congressional District has been a steady Republican vote for the last 6 years. But a bunch of Democrats are lining up to take on Republican Kevin Yoder, suggesting that Democrats are more confident than usual about their prospects there. Remember, Hillary Clinton carried the district over Donald Trump in last year's presidential election. KCUR's Jim McLean of the Kansas News Service has been sizing up the district. He joins us now by phone from Topeka. And Jim, it's always good to have you here. Welcome.
Hey, thanks, Steve. Always good to be here.
Democrats appear to think they've got a shot here, Jim. How realistic is that, do you think?
Well, I don't know. Even in normal political times, I was talking to Patrick Miller. He's a political scientist over at KU.
Right.
Yeah, the district, he calls it, I was intrigued, he calls it a swingy district, meaning the registration is fairly close, and it's been getting closer over the years. Of course, Yoder has held this seat for four terms and is seeking a fifth term. But before that, you remember, Dennis Moore held the seat for a dozen years. So it is a competitive district. And as you pointed out in the intro, Hillary Clinton won it over Donald Trump, albeit by only a point. So I think Democrats feel in this era of Trump and all the controversy that surrounds his presidency that they have a shot. And that's why you see so many of them lining up to compete for the opportunity to challenge Yoder next fall.
Well, tell us about some of these Democrats. Who are they, Jim?
Well, they kind of run the gamut, Steve. Andrea Ramsey is a fairly intriguing figure. She's a retired corporate attorney who served as president of Turner House, the board of Turner House, which is a safety net clinic in Wyandotte County. And so she has those healthcare credentials. And she was busy just deciding what she wanted to do in retirement until President Trump got elected. And that affected her so deeply, she started thinking about, okay, what can I do? And what she ended up concluding was that she needed to run for Congress. And I attended a recent house party, a fundraising event in Johnson County, and there seems to be some real enthusiasm around her campaign. And she raised a couple $100,000 after being in the race for only a couple of weeks. Hmm. And then there's Tom Nierman, who's a high school history teacher. He's taught in Wichita, Lawrence, and the Kansas City area. He threw his hat into the ring recently as well. And there are several other people in the race as well. Reggie Marcellus, who ran a couple of years ago and lost. And Jay Seide, who was the 2016 Democratic nominee, has not announced yet, but everybody is expecting him to announce because he came within about 10, 11 points of Yoder 2 years ago.
I was going to say, there was a moment in that election, that 2016 race, right, between Jay Seide and Kevin Yoder, maybe a month out, where a lot of us were thinking, man, Jay Seide just might get there.
Right, exactly right. And he says he got into the race late, had only about 5 months to campaign. And as you say, the polls were tightening to a great degree about a month out from that race. And then Yoder just kind of coasted away from him with a lot of late money. And we should point out, too, that Yoder is his war chest is brimming full as we speak. He's got more than $1 million on hand as he prepares to start campaigning for reelection. He raised $800,000 in the most recent report. Reporting period. Jay Seide, on the other hand, raised only about $30,000 compared to Andrea Ramsey's $200,000.
Hmm. And again, just for the sake of context here, and you just alluded to this, Jim, Congressman Yoder, he won pretty easily in 2016 by nearly 11 points last year in a district that, again, Hillary Clinton carried. On some levels, that doesn't really suggest a whole lot of vulnerability.
Yeah, you're right. 2 years ago, and I guess the question would be, how much has the landscape changed?
Mm-hmm.
At that time, I think most people headed to the polls. People were honest, they expected, whether they were for her or against her, expected Hillary Clinton to win that race. She didn't. President Donald Trump did. And we've seen a White House like we've never seen before over the first 200 days of his presidency. So I think the big question right now is, how much has that changed the political environment across the country?
Mm-hmm.
But particularly in these 23 districts across the country where Clinton won the district over Trump, that alone would seem to create kind of more vulnerability than perhaps we saw 2 years ago.
But I should point out that even if Democrats would win every single one of those 23 seats, Jim, that still wouldn't be enough to give them a majority in the U.S. House out in Washington. They'd still be a little short.
That's right. They need 24 seats to take the majority. They're targeting more than 50 of these districts across the country. 10 of the districts are districts where Hillary Clinton lost, but only by a few points. So they think that those are also competitive. And there are quite a few open seats as well. So we'll just have to wait and see. I mean, obviously, I think the Democrats would be very disappointed with anything other than kind of a wave election, given mm-hmm. all the controversy surrounding President Trump and his approval ratings. But a lot can happen in a year, and you know that as well as anybody.
You know, I heard your report this morning, and Democrats making a point of Kevin Yoder's vote for the Republican alternative to the Affordable Care Act. I'm talking, again, obviously about health care here. If there's one vote that raised eyebrows this time around, that might be the one that gets talked about maybe the most here.
I think you're right about that, Steve. And one reason I think that's true is because the bill failed ultimately. You know, had that bill made its way through the process and been massaged and tweaked and changed, he would have some cover on this. But, you know, he was out front on the first vote when the House passed it very narrowly, only to send it over to the Senate. And we all know what happened there with John McCain and his thumbs down vote at the very in the wee hours of the morning. So I think that changes the context of this issue a little bit, because I'm not sure the Republicans will be able to keep their repeal and replace promise. And so that vote is kind of sticking out there in a way that's very obvious and something that people can hang on to as evidence that he is voting with the conservative leadership in the House and President Trump. I think you're right. I think that's a vote that people will pay attention to, and you'll get a lot of discussion over the next year.
We're talking about the Kansas 3rd District Congressional race looming in 2018 with KCUR's Jim McLean. Do you have a sense, Jim, of how interested the National Democratic Party is in the 3rd District of Kansas? Is this on their radar screen?
I think very much it is. I think we said in the piece this morning that they've kind of, I'm not sure they've circled it in red, but certainly they have circled it. It's one of the run of the races that the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, highlighted in a January memo as a race that they're planning to target. So I think that there's a great deal of attention to this district nationally. I think Democrats think that it is competitive. I should also mention that the Kansas's 2nd congressional district was also on that list. That's the seat that Lynn Jenkins, a veteran congresswoman from Topeka, is leaving. She's retiring, and so it's an open seat. Mm-hmm. And Paul Davis, the Democrat who narrowly lost to Sam Brown back in 2014 in the governor's race, has indicated an interest in that race. And the Republicans that are getting into that race so far aren't what I would call marquee names. So that race could also be interesting.
You can read Jim's report on the 3rd district race in Kansas at kcur.org. Jim, always appreciate you taking some time. Thanks very much.
Happy to do it, Steve. Thanks a bunch.
You bet. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On tomorrow's show, how black doctors and patients navigate the complexities of race and medicine, and we'll brief you on the results of today's election in Kansas City, Missouri. Denny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar produced this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.